So I've been at Netflix for a really long time. People don't realize that Netflix has been around as long as it has, but I actually met Reed Hastings, the founder of Netflix, in 1999 and joined the company in early 2000. So about I've been almost 18 years at Netflix. And back in the early days, we were just mailing DVDs around the US only. And then added streaming, then added international, and added original programming. So the company's a radically different company about every 2 years. And I've got to see a lot of this change. So my path to it was I knew all about the home video business at a time when Netflix was a DVD business, and Reed knew all about how to put up a great website and make all these things work, but really didn't know about the film distribution side. So we complemented each other in that way and continued to as we kept evolving the business. That is, you know, at some point equal parts engineering and tech and creative, and at some points, depending on where you sit, sometimes it's, you know, one's up here, one's down here. But they're very mutually dependent. I mean, it's very important that you can make great content, but if the site, if it doesn't work, no one cares. And you can make really lousy content, but if it delivers well, people won't care about that either. So you need to have both. So that was my path into Netflix. Over the years, we've developed into making original programming all over the world. You mentioned earlier all the shows we make in Mexico and major films like Roma, and Bird Box, and so we're continuing to grow all these things. So a day in my life, a lot of times, is that he can attest to this, is I have removed myself from a lot of the day-to-day decision-making of what gets made and what gets put on Netflix, because I've got an incredible team with incredible taste and great local market knowledge who make great choices. And for me, it's mostly about problem solving, I think. So I get called into things, shows and films that may be problematic, some that are very high risk, either very high budget or something that's very high risk of completing. I have find myself in the position of kind of talent relations, so I know a lot of the people in Hollywood who make the movies and television shows, and I get pulled into those relationships to help smooth the path to getting deals done, very increasingly complicated deals done. So my day starts with trying to get grounded in the news and a lot of internal meetings, followed by a lot of external meetings, followed with a lot of watching. So I probably spend 2 to 3 hours a day watching our content being as it's being made. Well, it's funny, my people always ask me what I'm watching, and it's hard because I'm on a different schedule than you, because we get the shows delivered one at a time. So we're not only watching them several months before the rest of the world, we don't get to binge, because we're watching them as they get delivered. So sometimes very frustrating if you're really enjoying the show too. As an example, like right now, there's an upcoming miniseries coming up called Unbelievable, that's based on a series of magazine articles. It was called The Unbelievable True Story of Rape. That is an unbelievably powerful true crime story that's going to be told out in 8 parts, and I'm only on I only have the 5th hour, and I'm jonesing for the rest of it soon. So, well, I'm a huge fan of Club de Cuervos. I from the beginning, what I loved about that show was that it was it had all the family dynamics and drama, but it also was very funny, and I just found it was very funny. And I'll be honest with you, in the first season for me, is I didn't recognize a lot of the slang, so I was missing a lot of the jokes. Mm-hmm. So it's over the 4 years, it's helped me now that I understand the humor of the show much more. Diablera, I love it because it's scary, and it's angels and demons and classic good and evil storytelling, but set in modern Mexico, you know, which is awesome. And then, of course, you know, the last several months of my life have been very busy with Roma. So both starting with the Venice Film Festival, that seems like it was 10 years ago now when we first introduced the film, to as recently as last night when it won 4 BAFTA awards. Well, again, you know, I mentioned it earlier, but Club de Cuervos was our first show. And what I realized was that when we could have a better chance of making international programming kind of close to home. So we were only a couple hours away. So our exposure to the market was better. We got to know the storytellers better, the producers better. We took a really, at that time, was a pretty innovative step of working with an independent filmmaker, with Gaz, to develop the show, who had not worked in television before, really, but to produce it like an independent film, but with multiple episodes. And what you find is if you pick the right people and give them the resources to make their content, all the resources are in Mexico. The production infrastructure, the writers, the incredible acting talent. So we have found it continues to scale and scale and scale. And we're producing quite a bit of original programming in Mexico. And for the next couple of days, we'll be announcing a pretty aggressive rollout. So we're excited.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Well, you know, it's funny. I think everyone is really fascinated with what's different around the world. Like, how is this different than this? And what I'm most fascinated by, what's the same? I'm always fascinated by the fact that great stories travel everywhere. So our local language shows that play around the world, mostly because they're just great stories and great shows, and they're produced well, and people want to see them. And they use Netflix for what we should be using it for, which is to solve the language barrier with technology and subtitling and dubbing in a way that people can really watch the same shows with the same level of passion. What I really think is amazing about Mexico is the local originals in Mexico that people get in Mexico, I think, are probably our most passionate fan base. I mean, they jump in faster, they jump online and talk about it more. It's you hear people talking about it all over the country when we have a big hit show. And it's a real affinity for local storytelling, which makes sense because it's such a beautiful country with such a great diversity of history and culture that, you know, the well will never run dry here. Well, mostly authenticity. I mean, I think that one thing that's, everyone always wants to know how to stand out and mostly you can stand out by your unique life. And how do you put your unique life into your storytelling? What makes you different from everybody else? And why is your story different than everybody else? It's only because of your perspective. That's what you own and that's what you have the copyright on, is your own perspective. So what we're looking for is people to tell authentic stories from their hearts. Shows that are really developed and characters that are developed and worlds that are developed, thinking that in success, fans are gonna spend years with these people and years in this place. So the ability not just to have a good idea, because there is no shortage of ideas, but the ability to execute on it too, which is a rarity. And that's what I hope is happening at this school right now, which is really exciting. There's something, once you try to make something lighter, you know, a lighter version of it, a little less Mexican, the chances are no one will want to watch it. They want to watch it in Mexico or anywhere else because it will just feel inauthentic to them. And we saw it even with Narcos. When Narcos started playing around the world, I would argue with people. They'd say, it's not in Spanish. I go, no, it's all in Spanish. The whole 85% of the show's in Spanish. No, I just watched it. It's not in Spanish. And because they get so wrapped up in the storytelling and what's happening and how authentic and real the show is, they don't even realize they're reading subtitles by the end of the first episode. So there was a temptation. Remember, Narcos came into us to be an American show. Set in Mexico, but it was going to be all in English. And when they started delivering the cuts, the scenes in Spanish just made sense. The guys are speaking English when no one would be speaking English. It just didn't look real. So that show to add the level of grit to it was to make sure to continue to do it in local language. And it's a global show that happens to be set in Mexico, in Colombia for the first season, but the new season here in Mexico. Well, we're trying to make films that people want to watch. And that sounds like a very broad mandate, but people's tastes are very different. And then getting away from taste, even mood. So, you know, you may love Roma one night, but the next night you just want to take it easy and watch an Adam Sandler comedy because you just want to laugh. And people use movies for different things. And one of them is to escape and enjoy. And so we're making movies, you know, everything from, you know, very low budget independent films that you might see at the Sundance Film Festival, all the way up to a couple $100 million budgets, like Michael Bay making a movie right now for us called Six Underground. I think it's the challenge really is change. So you guys are studying to be in an industry that has been pretty much the same since the beginning. The television shows don't get made much differently than they used to. They get monetized differently and they get distributed differently and they get consumed differently. But for the most part, the creation part is exactly the same. So when you think about like the pathway to getting things made and how they get made, and the challenge I think is the power and the infrastructure about who owns theaters and who owns television networks and all those things. It's, you know, nobody wants to give any of that up for good reason. And but you have to change with the audience, and you have to change with how people behave. So I find, you know, we've been in a very fortunate position at Netflix that at no point in our professional careers have we ever spent any energy trying to protect anything. We're not trying to protect our business. We're trying to build a great business. And once you start protecting the way you start seeing it, like, you know, insisting on longer windows to protect movie theaters, or not selling things to one place so you could protect DVDs and all those kind of things. All those things were happening over and over again. And I think the ability for Netflix to embrace, so we're fortunate that we didn't have an old legacy business to try to protect, and we could just innovate on behalf of the consumers. So I think the biggest challenge of this is that we have a lot of big companies that are run by the same people who are running them 20 years ago. And today the consumer is radically different. And my son goes to a school, a beautiful school like this in California, studying to be an editor. And, you know, I was told this story before, but he has only seen Lawrence of Arabia on his phone. So to him, it's like, that's like, no, what's wrong with that? Of course. And yet when I say that out loud in LA to people, they think it's sacrilege, you know. Fairly traditional, but we have people in market, yourself are one, that really know and get to know the production communities, get to know the storytellers and the creators, get to know through the markets, through the festivals, and basically just being feet on the ground. And increasingly, we're spending much more time in Mexico. But in general, there's a pitch process, which really is just getting your story into somebody like yourself, and you could elaborate that a little bit too. But what's the best way to get to you with a project?
Well, I think
sometimes at me they throw it over the fence at my house, so I go to you. I was saying earlier, you know, you have a project that from a well-known creator, it's a lot easier step to take with them because you've seen it over and over again that they've been able to create a very interesting big world and deliver it over and over again. When we made Orange Is the New Black, that creator Jinji Cohen had just come after 8 years of Weeds, so it didn't seem like a hard thing for her to adapt that show. But when you work with someone brand new, you have to take a leap of faith. And an interesting one for Bill is the Duffer Brothers, who created Stranger Things. When they brought that to Netflix, it had been passed on 19 times by 15 different companies. And we just had the ability to take a leap with them. A lot of that has nothing to do with data, has nothing to do with anything but intuition and hunch to say, this is a great world these guys have created. It's incredibly complicated, but it's really fun. It's based in the real joy of 80s movies, and how can they do this complicated thing if they've never done it before? Well, basically they made a couple of episodes of a TV show called Wayward Pines, and they made a very low budget movie for Warner Brothers that never got released. And when we were kind of on the edge of, should we say yes to these guys or not, I asked if we could see the movie, which we did, and you realize, wow, on a very low budget, these guys have created a really great film and just gave us the confidence to say yes, got into business with them. So it's really the range of creators is everything from first time to long time. The tools to tell stories have never been more accessible and inexpensive. So both from lightweight digital cameras, even your iPhone. We just released a movie last week on Netflix directed by Steven Soderbergh that he shot entirely on an iPhone. It's called High Flying Bird. It's really, you should check it out. It's a great movie. And so the tools are right there. You can, there's editing tools now and mixing tools, the things that are in many cases in your back pocket right now to make a movie. And there's distribution tools via the internet that you could make your projects and get them out in front of people and get, just start the process of telling stories. If you are a storyteller, you must tell stories. If you're a writer, write. If you're a director, shoot. You know, if you're a composer, write music and get it out in front of people as best you can. And not, don't get hung up, it's easy for me to say this, but don't get hung up on how do you make money at it. Because I don't know anybody who got into this business to make money and was super successful. It's a really lousy way to make money in a way, because the chances that you will can be very small relative to everything that's out there. But the fact that if you focus on what you're doing, which is telling great stories, you're almost sure to be successful. And if you do it over and over again, you'll be great at it. And you know, keep to put it in front of you, ask for people for feedback. The one thing I would say not to do is like, again, this is self-serving, but like random emails, they get ignored. Write a handwritten note. If you really do, I want to send something, get something in front of somebody, a handwritten note now is such a...
You'll pay attention to it.
I'll totally pay attention to it every time. The other thing I think, like, someone gave up-and-coming creators the bad advice of, if you see somebody, stop them on the street and tell them about your project. It's really bad advice. Because they're not engaged and they're not listening. They're just trying to get away sometimes. And it's not the worst, so it's not the right environment to do it. But so a really professional approach, you know, especially how do you rise above the noise? Everyone can write an email. It doesn't cost anything. Just really, literally a handwritten letter. I read every single one of those. So just as an example, I think of people always say, like, this is my one shot, and they pounce on it. And your idea probably isn't ready yet anyway. You know, so don't take that shot.
Hi, my name is Brenda. I'm a screenwriter, and I'm wondering, for a pitch session, how ready should you be? Should you read? Should you bring with you just a Bible or a script, or how many badges, or I don't know.
So I think it's you should be three deep. So I think you should have a very fast elevator pitch, which is, this is why you want to buy this show, this is what I'm setting out to do, and this is how we're going to do it. I think you should have a draft. I know people, like I said about having the tools, it's mostly your energy and your time, but have a draft that is specifically what it is. So, and who you want your buyer to be, because it doesn't happen as often as it used to, but a lot of times we would get pitches that were meant for a broadcast or open television or broadcast television, and knowing that's not the way we make it, but they go, we can adapt it for you. I said, well, you know, if it's not, we want to see it in its purest form, what it's supposed to be. And then a Bible is helpful, but one thing to keep in mind, I mean, I'd be curious just by a show of hands, if you have just as fans of, if you think this is accurate, but these long, long running shows, I'm wondering if that's going to be the future of television in the long run, because I feel like it's one of these things when you watch a show and you're a big fan of it, and then you wait a year and the new season comes out, it's hard to get excited about even getting back to that show, even though you loved it the first season, because in that year that it came out, another 1,000 TV shows came out, and you're competing with everything that was ever made always. So I'm wondering if it's not going to be one of those things where you should start thinking about that the measure of success is in how many years you can make your show, but how many years can your show be great? And when you sell a show the first season, it's a creative endeavor. It's that story that's been burning inside of you that you finally got on paper, that you finally got produced. That's season one. Season two is, now what are you gonna do? You got 6 months to write it, you got 5 months to write it, and try to keep this whole thing together. So it becomes an economic endeavor, which makes it less likely to be successful. So I'll be curious to see if one of the evolutions of the new era of television is when you come in to pitch, instead of pitching me an infinite Bible, you're saying, here is how I'm going to tell this show, this story in 5 episodes, in 10 episodes, in 15 episodes, and that's it. How many people here have loved the first season of a show and never watched anymore, but still loved the first season? See, that seems crazy, right? So, and the other thing that's funny about it is movies, very few movies get sequels, but every television show is supposed to get a sequel. So it'll be an interesting thing to see how on-demand television, how the way you watch will change the way how things get made.
Thank you, I didn't want to scream.
Hi.
You sounded good, you heard it.
Thank you. I have a question about licensing. So I heard somewhere or read somewhere, I don't know if this is right, but that you were planning eventually to stop the content you have, like the licensed content you have, and just focus on creating original content for the platform.
No, that's not true. We do it less, but not because we're trying to get away from it. We started making original programming back with House of Cards because we believed that the studios and networks were gonna, at some point, they would probably wanna start their own direct-to-consumer services and not want to sell us their content. And that if we did find ourselves in that position, that we should try to get really good at making our own shows. And that's what started us down that road. So a lot of shows, in some cases, like Disney, that's come true. In other cases, I'd say different companies around the world are in different states of that, right? Either they don't want to sell the show to us anymore, or the clearing price to buy the show is just so high that it doesn't make sense and we should be making our own. But we're not trying to move away from licensing particularly. We want as many great shows as we can.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, just a little history, how fast this has changed. In the television world, they do this thing called May screenings, where they make all the TV shows for the networks in the US, and then during the month of May, all the buyers from all over the world come and try to buy the rights for those shows. And what we found was, in the early days of Netflix, we used to go and we would target 15, 16 shows a year, every year, because they were that good and we wanted them. And now, not only are they making fewer shows, the shows that we are getting excited about to license every year in the last 2 years, it's been maybe two. There's less interesting things being made to license. So, and then the other thing we've done is moved up a little bit. So instead of those shows coming into the marketplace and then we go in and negotiate the deal, we're co-producing a lot of times with people in all over the world, where a show may premiere on a network in one country and then premiere on Netflix everywhere else in the world, like The Bodyguard, which was co-production with ITV, and BBC took the first window in the US, in the UK, and Netflix premiered it everywhere else in the world.
Hi Ted, my name is Daniel, and I am part of the TV Showrunner Diploma course here. And I wanted to ask you the following. On a recent Variety magazine interview, you mentioned that Netflix is looking for a unique breed of showrunners. So in this case, which are the qualities you think we as showrunners must have in order to succeed?
Well, it's funny, we were just talking about this earlier, about it's great that you have the program. It's not that usual, by the way. You guys are in a very lucky position to be to have a program like this here. In LA, you know, where people are so excited about entertainment, they still teach courses on writing pilots, which no one's even making pilots. But I would tell you that the unique qualities of a great showrunner is that they're obviously great creators, but also CEOs. I mean, basically being a showrunner is like being a CEO of a big company. You have a ton of a million problems that come up throughout the course of a show. You're building writers' rooms, you're doing incredibly complex production constantly with a lot of people, a lot of moving parts. So I would think it's that great balance of management skill and creativity. And a lot of times that comes best in the form of a partnership. And somebody who has a great creator who understands them really well, and who has the better business mind and can help run with those logistics. So I find that the best showrunners have incredible partners in almost every case.
I am Ariana. I'm from the ABC Showrunner as well. And I would like to know what kind of research Netflix is doing. And of this kind of the research that you're doing, what are you sharing to the other producer? You know, like, for example, if I make a first production and I'm successful, do you share, you know, data for me to be successful with my second
Definitely.
Season?
So there's a lot of press about Netflix not telling the numbers, like the ratings and what people watch. We do share that very openly and very on a pretty granular level with the showrunners and creators, because for the reason you just stated, we want them to be successful. This is what's working, this is what isn't, this is what things are working around it and what isn't, this is how many people are watching it in the first month, which is a metric that we care about, and we do definitely share that data with the creators.
Hi, I have two questions that are sort of intertwined. The first one is, once you receive a project, is it purely gut, is it purely intuition that you say, I want to make this show? Or is there, and like categories of, you know, this is targeted for certain people, or we need more content that is for comedy, or we need more content for Latins in America, or we need, is there like a lot of?
Well, there's about 2,000 content categories that what you're talking about, and so we're always looking to fill all of them. But it's not, we're generally like not saying, looking for something that you will bring to us. It is basically where does that fit into kind of what we're looking for? Are we heavy in one area and not another? What's interesting, Netflix is not like a network where we have a few hours to fill, right? It's like dozens of networks with lots of programming sensibilities. So it's not like we're only looking for things that for young men or for, you know, for women in Mexico. We're looking for great programming that fits all kinds of tastes, all kinds of needs. The thing that it is, the intuition part is, a lot of it is, wow, this is amazing. Can this be made on a budget? And then it is, can we support that budget? And the way you do that is by trying to figure out the best you can how big the audience will be for a show. And we have a bunch of data that we look at to try to figure that out. And I think we're as good at it as anybody, but we get surprised a lot. So we've had shows that we, you know, that came in that we thought were gonna bomb and they turned out to be hits. And we've had shows that the opposites happen. But it's the truth of it is, it's the intuition of knowing this is a good story that needs to be told and can be told. And then it's the next level. You keep kind of digging deeper. Can it be told? Yes. Can it be done on a budget? Yes. Is that budget supported by an audience? Yes. And when you could check all those boxes, we can get a deal done.
So, but is there any like specific, like if we were gonna go into do a project now, is there any specific target that would be like, hey, there's nothing really going on for women or for, I don't know, special needs, like something that's specific that you would recommend, or just pitch the story and if it's good, it'll...
100%. It's just got to be a great story. Because a lot of times people look at some of the best shows, you know, but there's all these programming decisions start with conventional wisdom, and most of that proves to be wrong. So remember when we were talking about Stranger Things earlier, I was trying to figure out why did everybody pass on this show? So the belief was, of all the TV networks, was you cannot make a show for adults that stars kids. Someone just said it, and they believe it. And so no one bought it. And so that's what I think is one of those things where don't buy into those things. Haunting on Hill House, it's a family drama and a horror show wrapped in and around, which most people would say the thing you want to avoid is something that's two things. A feathered fish, you know, something that is too scary for drama fans and too dramatic for horror fans. But it turns out if you find the right balance, it's perfect. So it's all in the execution.
Hi, Ted, my name is Joe. I have two questions. Well, I have a lot of questions, but I limit myself to two. The first thing is, my movie is streaming on Netflix right now.
Put a plug. You got a big audience right now.
Yeah, plug it. Thanks. It got released on December 1st. It's been 2 months now, and the only data I really know that more people is seeing my movie on Netflix that it did on theaters when it got released on June last year is tweets, because there's a lot more tweets about my movie now than before.
That's a real thing.
If that is, as a director and producer, I want to know the numbers. Do I have to go via my distribution company who got the movie to you, or is there a way for creators who have their content up there already to get the numbers? Yeah. El Club de los Insomnes. If you can watch it, that would be great.
Yes, yes.
Love to get your feedback.
Absolutely.
Of course.
Second question. This is more about Netflix than my data. Joining 2 or 3 weeks ago the MPAA after Fox leaving because of the merger with Disney, What does that represent for Netflix? What will change in your strategy? Or are you going to try to focus more on film than TV shows? Or what position does that get you to now?
Well, it's not about switching focus from TV show to film. We're already one of the most, putting out more films than any studio in the world.
Yeah.
What it really represents is, we're the first new member of the MPAA in 60 years. And so what it really represents is our ability to infuse some new thinking into that organization. These other members we're very similarly aligned in that they have big streaming services that they want to, you know, distribute content all over the world the same way we're doing it today. So I would say that our interests are more highly aligned than they were before, and that I think that we can bring a kind of new thinking to the MPAA to help, you know, solve a lot of problems, and that we can help change the MPAA from inside much more effectively than we could from the outside.
Like closing the windows from exhibition and stuff like that?
Who knows? That could be a bunch of other issues on there. That's something that we're just doing. So we're not trying to influence others to do it. We're just doing that with our films. We have no agenda to do any of those things. We're just doing it with our films because we believe our customers don't want to wait 6-9 months to watch a movie on Netflix. And to your point, when the bigger, hungrier audience is already there now, that we could bring it directly. And we've done it all over the board, from a couple of weeks early, like in case of Roma, a couple of days early, like the case of Bird Box and Buster Scruggs. But the vast majority of our films go in theaters and on Netflix the same day. We released over 30 films in theaters last year. And so we'll continue to do that. We don't need a trade organization to figure that out. So that's the path that we're taking.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Never cancel BoJack Horseman.
Glad you're a fan.
Hi here. My question is, I would really like to know what is your personally opinion about the movie theater business, and if it's truth that Netflix is going to get into that business.
Well, you should know I'm a huge fan of the theaters. Several times a month I'm buying a ticket and going to a movie theater and watching a movie as a fan. I think it is a unique experience. It's not the same as watching a movie at home. It's bigger, it's louder. You're more likely to sit next to somebody you don't know. Those are all true differences between watching a movie at home and in the theater. But also the real distinguishing thing is people just want to go out. So one thing that's great, when we release our movies day and date and they're in theaters, we did a survey in a New York theater once, and about 80% of the people who bought the ticket to go see that movie were Netflix subscribers, meaning they could have watched it at home and they chose to go out that night. And I bet that's the case everywhere you go, because people who love movies and television shows go to the movies. We really just are just not in that business. So if you see us doing things in theaters, mostly it is we want to promote choice for fans who choose to do want to see that movie and do want to go out. And we're also doing it to support our filmmakers who, in many cases, it was their vision to see that film on a big screen, and we were helping them realize that vision. But there's no agenda that has anything to do with the movie theaters for Netflix.
My name is Jules.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. And I wanted to ask, you know, based on the huge success from both Roma and Club de Cuervos, what idea you have in terms of numbers of, you know, how many TV shows or how many films made in Mexico by Mexicans do you think you might be producing in the next year or couple of years? You know, because as an aspiring filmmaker in Mexico, this is like a huge deal to me.
Well, in the next couple of days, I'll be able to answer that question very specifically. but I can tell you this, we're going to need all of you. So please, we're going to be very busy in Mexico.
Bueno, muchas gracias a todos por acompañarnos. Y buenas noches.
Thank you.